Welcome to the Guffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themcguffinmen.com. We've got a lot of good content. We've talked about mostly good movies so far this year. Debatably, our last episode was one of those, depending on how you felt about Furious 7. But we've also talked about A Most Violent Year, The Maltese Falcon, Boyhood, Dog Day Afternoon, and Inside Man is a double podcast, and a handful of others. So check out the website, themcguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themcguffinmen to keep up with our latest activities, which is basically just us putting out podcasts. Yeah, that's about it. Anything you want to mention, James?
Nope, I don't think so.
That's,
is that worth it?
Yeah, that was definitely worth sitting through that pause. So we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, what are we talking about here today?
Casablanca,
the Casa of White. Yeah, the 1942, is that it?
Yep.
Michael Curtiz film that is well known, one of the more well-known American films ever made.
Yeah, one of the most well-respected. We're knocking off some of the classics lately.
Yeah, basically, we're trying to make it so that there are no more movies for us to talk about, basically. By episode 300, we want to ground this podcast in a non-existence.
Sounds good.
Yeah, because I feel like that's about when our friendship expires. It's episode 300.
Stick a dark turn quickly.
Yeah. Okay, so Casablanca.
It's as we said, I mean, it's described as one of the kind of most well-known, most well-respected American movies. And I think kind of what I didn't know about this movie, and I mean, this is a huge movie, just kind of pervasive throughout culture, tons of quotable lines mm-hmm. in the movie. Mm-hmm. But one thing I didn't really know about it before watching it a lot and researching it was it's a very Hollywood system movie.
Oh yeah, like, for sure.
kind of just with its place in culture, I always assumed that there is like one brilliant mind behind it. And, you know, that's how this fantastic piece of art was created. And it really wasn't anything like that. Like, this is when studios were pumping out hundreds of movies a year, and they just had their writers and actors and stable of stars to mm-hmm. kind of loan out and put in movies. And this is right in the middle of that. And it kind of, I don't know, I guess materialized a very happy accident. I mean, it's not to say that this was a really low budget, shitty movie. I mean, it is a stable of people, but it's, you know, your A-list.
Yeah.
It is Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. You know, these are huge names at the time, but it was not, in my understanding, meant to be what Casablanca ended up being.
No, and they start production on the film before the script is finished, which is generally a recipe for disaster. But in this instance, created Casablanca, so not disaster, I suppose, in this case.
Yeah, I mean, three people writing it at a time. Again, not always a great sign.
Yeah.
We should mention it was from an unproduced play, and it was bought for $20,000, the script, which was the largest amount that it would pay for an unproduced play to turn into a film yeah. or whatever that value is to you. And so, I mean, it, you know, there was kind of high hopes for this, but it really wasn't a huge deal. It was Irene Diamond, I think was her name, was a story. Warner Brothers and, pardon?
The what, sorry?
A story editor, I believe, at Warner Brothers. And she just loved the script and, you know, convinced the guys upstairs to buy it and make it into a movie. And so, you know, we had the script as for a play, but in order to turn it to a Hollywood film, you need a screenplay, and that's what those three writers were doing for this one. And it did end up winning Oscar for best screenplay, so I mean they did that right for sure.
Yeah.
But it just, yeah, I was just so shocked reading about how little was expected. And I mean, as I said, it wasn't a remarkably small movie or anything, just kind of for what we know it as now, it was certainly not predicted to be that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in a lot of the classic movies we've talked about, what does sort of carry these things through, even if it is kind of a torturous production like Jaws or something, there's still this through line through the picture of oftentimes it's the director of the person in charge. And in this case, Michael Curtiz is kind of renowned for, I mean, all you have to do is look at his filmography list on IMDb. He just cranked out movies. Like he's one of those, blue collar director, if you will, you know, just like, he's going to work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and it's going to come back with a picture, and it's going to be on time, and it's going to be almost on budget. And that is how I think he approached his career. And I think it really shows in this movie. Like, this movie looks wonderful. It looks very beautiful, but there are very few moments where I feel like there are, like, all of the dolly shots in this movie are incredible and grand and beautiful, but oftentimes it feels like they're there to be a dolly shot because they feel like, well, you know, the people will like a dolly shot here, you know, as opposed to something helping the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm probably going to say it a few more times. It's just, there's nothing really flashy about this movie. It's just a bunch of things do come together really, really nicely. And I heard one critic say, like, 2 cheesy things make a bad movie, but 100 of them together make a great film. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies to this movie. Like, to go back to what you said about kind of that through line, you know, you think of the great American films or other movies that are often put on that list, and you have The Godfather, and you have Citizen Kane.
Vertigo.
Yeah, I mean, we have directors who we know, like famous directors whose body of work we know a lot about, and that's what, you know, made those movies into what they are and made them stick with them, as you said, through sometimes torturous productions. Mm-hmm. This is such a hodgepodge. And, you know, you're describing Tony Curtis's working style, Curtiz.
Michael, you're mixing him up with Tony Curtis.
Yes, I sure am. Michael Curtiz, you know, as being very kind of working class and kind of just really a lot more usual for that time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I go back to them having kind of a stable of writers and a stable of stars and all these sets from other movies that they shot 3 months ago. It really was a factory, and they really were, you know, grinding out these movies. But then you have, you know, Maltese Falcon, which we talked about recently, and movies like this that you just have kind of undeniably talented actors and a good script and, you know, maybe these just efficient directors who know exactly what it takes to make a movie, and somehow we get something that's really more than the sum of its parts. And I think this is a perfect example of that. You know, you said the shots don't have anything really flashy. Some of the lines, I mean, to go back to that thing about being kind of having 2 cheesy things can be bad, but you put enough of them together and it works. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a wonderful screenplay in a lot of ways. But then, you know, you do get those very cheesy melodramatic moments. And maybe my opinion of that now has been influenced by being exposed to elements of this movie over and over and over in pop culture. But I just was so fascinated by how this was kind of just another one of those movies. It was just another movie we were going to make this year, and it turned into something that's so well respected.
Yeah, for sure. I do want to go back to your Maltese Falcon reference just for 1 second, because since, you know, that was one of the last movies we discussed on this podcast, and because it has Bogey in it and Sidney Greenspan and Peter Lorre, I was just sort of naturally thinking about it. The Maltese Falcon pops off the screen more than Casablanca does. I feel like the Maltese Falcon has sort of a more that more of that through line that we discussed that I feel like Casablanca kind of lacks. and just sort of, it feels like the moves and the shot setups and the sets sort of have more of a distinct feel to them in the Maltese Falcon, despite the fact that they come out of the exact same system in Hollywood. And I think it's just, I suppose the difference between those things is Michael Curtis versus John Huston, basically. And yeah, it's not like Casablanca isn't a beautiful movie, because it is, but I just feel like there's something more about the Maltese Falcon that really pops off the screen. Even if it's just the tons of silhouette shots, not to say Casablanca doesn't have silhouette shots, or that long take with Sidney Greenspan and Humphrey Bogart in the Maltese Falcon, but there's just something about the Maltese Falcon that felt more composed from one sort of point of view, you know, and that will always lead itself, or you know, make me like it more, you know. It's just something, yeah, that's just something I look for in filmmaking.
Yeah, and I can see that. I mean, we talked about kind of film noir a lot when we did Maltese Falcon, and just those whites and darks. And yeah, it's definitely a more visually arresting movie.
Yeah. And even just comparing the two takes
kind of playing with light, pardon?
Even just like comparing the two types of takes on noir, right? You've got sort of the like, I suppose the hard noir, if you will, on the Maltese Falcon, and Casablanca's kind of a noir, but it's also like this sweeping romance at the same time. It's sort of like, this is the romance for every, or sorry, the noir for us all, whereas the Maltese Falcon yeah. might exclude some people, you know?
Yeah, no, I could see that for sure. I never thought of that, but that is a good point. Like, this movie is, you know, you've got your kind of thriller intrigue because of the military situation. You've tons of really funny stuff, because just screenplays around this time are full of really snappy dialogue,
yeah.
and Bogey being Bogey can make that work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's just such a huge romance element to this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't want to call it just a romance story or a love story, but it's definitely the most, I would think, the most prominent part of this movie.
I would agree.
Yeah. You know the critic Andrew Saris?
Of course I do.
Of course you do. He's a big proponent of auteur theory.
Mm-hmm.
He says this movie is the most decisive exception to auteur theory. And I think for the reasons we were discussing, like, he's not saying this is a bad movie at all. It's just that we can have kind of a successful movie come from this really collaborative, often very quick process that Hollywood filmmaking was at in the 40s.
Yeah, for sure.
we briefly talked about Bogey recently, Humphrey Bogart. I pointed out to you that he often looks so tired.
Yeah, because he's hungover or still drunk. One
or
of the
still
two.
Drunk. I thought that look worked so well for him in this movie.
Yes, 100%. I actually think Bogart's kind of really good in this movie.
I think he's perfect for what we need him to do.
Well, yeah, for sure. But one of the things I like the most about this movie is not necessarily the sequence itself in a vacuum, but the idea behind the Paris sequence, where we see Happy Rick, you know, him and Ilsa together in Paris. You know, they'll always have that no matter what. They were happy there and in love, and Bogey's hair seems to be a bit darker. And he smiles in those portions of the movie, you know. And then as Ilsa leaves, or doesn't even leave him, just doesn't show up to the train station, we kind of see Rick become the Bogey character. You know, we see him read this note in the Tears and Rain portion of this film. and we see him read the note and hear that Ilsa isn't going to be coming. And then by the time the train has left the station, he has become this hardened version of Rick that we get throughout the rest of the movie. He crumples up the note and throws it away. It's just like, well, I've been hurt. All right, moving on and moving out of the station to Casablanca. I like him in this movie a lot. And Rick is certainly the part of this movie that I don't have a lot of bad things to say about. I think that's the stuff I really enjoy, is the stuff about Rick's heartbreak, basically. Yeah.
Yes, which is very central. Yeah, no, he's interesting because he's not just an asshole. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he's been jaded by this experience, and now everyone who meets him hates him because he's so, you know, impolite or cold or anything like that.
he's just very dispassionate. Like, he, you know, they say he's neutral on everything. And the first, I mean, for the first two thirds of this movie, it's just about him really not caring about anything and staying neutral and, you know, not sticking his neck out for anybody. Mm-hmm. And then we see kind of glimpses of the noble hero that is within Rick. And, you know, the first time Laszlo gets mentioned is the first time you really see Rick kind of perk up, and he compliments him and, you know, says all these nice things about him when he isn't around, seemingly for no reason other than that's just genuinely how he feels. And yeah, the first kind of hour of this movie is just him not feeling anything, and him, you know, politically, romantically, business wise, like, it's just none of that really seems to matter to him. And he's just very dispassionate and separated. And it's, you know, the character arc for him is him kind of re-embracing that person he was when he was fighting on these losing sides of these wars. And, you know, the way he'll rig a roulette game at his own casino to give people money to get out of the country. It's just playing with, like, it's just the slow reveal of him as a genuinely good guy, but he plays the cold, dispassionate thing so well that, I don't know, you're not even in a rush to see him turn good. Like, it's so entertaining. It's not like he's just a villain or anything. He just really tries to occupy that middle space, and with a very funny script and some very good delivery, I think it's, like, by far one of the strongest elements of this movie for me.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and I mean, that's the character type that Bogey was, you know. That's the that's what he excelled at playing. And you know, post the Maltese Falcon, his most widely or I suppose his most enduring roles are things that kind of play on that persona that we already knew for him to have, being this, and I always think of The Treasure of Sierra Madre as well. And yeah, it's interesting. And also, since he's like, Casablanca also kind of feels like the movie that our version of Bogey wouldn't really like. Like, he'd have issues. He'd be like, oh, it's sappy, it's a love story, you know? Or, that wasn't a good Bogart impression, but you understand what I mean.
Yep.
He would much prefer the Maltese Falcon, you know what I mean? And with Casablanca, we get a movie that shows both Bogey, the character that we know, and what is probably closer to Bogart the man, in that, you know, nobody can really be as closed off as Bogey is and still kind of be successful in life. That's pretty difficult, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But, and I just think it's great how, you know, he's so neutral and everything is kind of his whole vibe for so much of this movie. And there was just a really small thing that he gets a different name from everybody. He's Richard to some, he's Rick, he's Ricky, he's Mr. Rick, he's Air something that the Germans call him. Like, he's this blank slate, and he gets to be kind of what he wants. He gets to be someone different to everybody. He just is kind of this thing for you to project on, and he's just he has no concern about he's so neutral, he doesn't even care what you think of him. Like, it's not even that he doesn't have opinions on things. He doesn't care that you have an opinion on him one way or the other. I thought that just one small thing in the script of giving him, letting everyone call him, like, they all call him the same thing over and over, each character share that name. And I thought that was a really interesting thing about him being in the middle of everything.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Rick's is kind of an interesting, just sort of as a setting, I find Rick's very interesting. It's like, you know, we see him outside of that, the cafe, so few times throughout the course of the movie. And of course, that's where the vast majority of the action takes place. But I like the idea of him basically leaving Paris without the woman that he loves. And what does he do when he gets to his destination? He kind of builds this cafe, and it's got his name on it, and it's kind of like this protective shell that keeps him protected from his past sadnesses. You know, he builds this beautiful, ornate, giant space where he's in control of everything. He's a figure people look up to, kind of, and all of this is sort of to create this environment where he can't be hurt again. He's staying neutral because if he commits to anything, it only leads in heartbreak, is what he learned.
Yeah, no. Yeah, definitely. And I think Rick's Cafe just it functions as a microcosm of the city of Casablanca, or, you know, all of Morocco, I guess. But it's this like middle ground where things don't apply. Like, it's French controlled, but it's like it's French territory. But unlike so much of actual France, it's not Nazi occupied yet. And it's this middle ground. And that's, you know, where Rick wants to live. It's this, but it's this. So it's net zero. You know what I mean? And he loves having this place. He loves having the city of Casablanca. And, you know, by the extension of that metaphor, like, he loves having Rick's Cafe is, you know, as I said, a microcosm of pretty much the same thing. Like, there's all these competing forces, so, you know, everything's rendered moot. He wants to have this little space in his cafe where all these serious world issues don't apply. But the thing that fuels Casablanca and his cafe is human trafficking and illegal gambling and political corruption. Like, it's all these very heavy real world things that make this little oasis in the middle of the desert possible. And you know, it's so funny for him to say, like, I'm just gonna run away from the world and get separate from it by going into this place. But no, you're just going into a place where all these things are coming to a head equally at the same time. Like, yeah. It's just the eye of the storm, right? And then, as we see throughout the movie, when, you know, the Germans start singing in there, and then we have the dueling anthem scene and the French people start singing, like, it's just that everything's being tugged from different sides simultaneously. It's not a place of peace at all. It's just a very volatile place. And that's, as the movie continues, it's just Rick discovering that not only can you not run from everything forever, like he wanted to do from Ilsa, but even where you run to escape those things, it isn't going to be perfect. And especially if you're going over a hotly contested piece of real estate during the greatest war humankind has ever known.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But he shows some of that partisanship throughout, as I said. You know, he wants to be seen as neutral, but it's clearly not the case. And, you know, he doesn't let that German bank employee into the, you know, back VIP section or whatever. Peter Lorre shouldn't be selling these visas for this much money. You know what I mean? Like, you see how he doesn't like him ripping off these refugees, when really that's just capitalism. That's supply and demand, which is something that American Rick should be 100% supportive of. But as much as he tries to hide it, there are things that are more important to him, and there are things that he truly does value.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. But the thing I always just kept focusing on the movie was, you know, just kind of thinking about, you know, a lot of times people like that are emotionally closed off to an extent. It's like you said, you have to kind of get to know them over time, which Casablanca eventually lets us do. And the thing I always find interesting about those characters is the difference between what they say and what they actually like think in their own quiet moments about themselves, you know. And I enjoy this sort of the version of this movie that exists in my head, with a lot of deleted scenes of Bogart quietly sitting by himself and thinking, well, why can't I just talk to people? Why can't I just be an emotional person? Why can't I just accept these things about myself? And it basically turns into a WTF with Marc Maron, like, interspersed throughout this movie. But I don't know. Those are the things that I found the most interesting, was trying to think of the things that Rick doesn't say, but definitely thinks to himself, you know, because he's not a dum-dum, you know, like he's a smart guy. And he's just so afraid, I think, of putting himself out there because he's been hurt so badly before, you know?
Right. So you don't find those scenes of him kind of drinking alone and bumming out or reflecting on the time in Paris as like too melodramatic and sweet? Like, you think that the movie needed more of that?
I think it needed less of that, and just needed to let my imagination make this movie better in my head. You know what I mean? those types of things where it's sort of like, it's the most cliched version of that type of thought, like a guy sitting with a bottle of gin or whiskey or whatever it is that he's drinking and thinking about his sadnesses, you know? Those are the things that are the more obvious things about this movie are the things I'm less crazy about. Whereas the idea of Rick's Cafe is sort of like this protective shield he's built for himself, where he can control everything in it, or at least thinks he can. That's really interesting to me. And the transition between the scenes in Paris, which are kind of, you know, just like scenes you could see in any other movie, to the moment where he throws away the note and sort of becomes this closed off Rick. You know, the Paris scenes are worth it for that note toss. You know what I mean? And the things I find the most interesting about this movie are always in the smaller things that come out of the scenes that I'm not crazy about, you know? So they both need to be there for me to like this movie. So they're both good in a way, but there's, you know, a side of them that's much more important to me than the other side, you know?
Right. More interesting side.
Exactly. And maybe part of it is just because Bogart is a very charismatic man. He's somebody that you are interested in following through this movie, that he sort of helps you bridge that gap between those two types of scenes, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned him drinking gin or whiskey alone. I'm thinking gin only because that one line about gin joints.
Yeah, exactly. of all the protective gin joint shields I've in the world, she had to buy, come into mind. Yeah.
Of all the metaphorically closed off heart said that I've ever, whatever, you get it.
Now we're really in a Mark Maron episode.
Joke landed. Yeah. How did you feel about the treatment of alcohol in this movie? Because like many 40s movies, it's everywhere.
Everybody's pretty much a high-functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, but I thought there was... I thought it was used, like, for a couple different purposes nicely. What did you think about it?
I like that it showed both sides of alcoholism, basically. It showed the cool side of alcoholism and then also the sad and alone and dark and just pounding drinks by yourself side. But I will say I didn't put a ton of thought into it.
Oh, okay. This has been your vibe lately, is going after the alcohol metaphors.
I think it's just, I don't know, I just kind of accept it as a part of the past, and I don't think about it as much in the older movies. But do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I had a few. One, I just want to point out 1940s problem solving. If your friend's depressed, we'll just go driving and get drunk all night. Good idea, Sam.
Yeah.
It's very prominent, as we said, in a lot of the 40s movies, it's just drinking all the time. But we see it kind of handled in different ways. Like we see, Louis Renault, I don't know exactly his captain.
sure. Military personnel,
the one who'd be in love with Rick if he were a woman.
Yes, that's correct.
Such weird dialogue sometimes. Anyway, you know,
without
he
the Hays
describes...
code, this is a much different romance film.
Oh yeah. You know, but he describes, you know, when he's ordering drinks for Laszlo, you know, he says it's a fun little game. They bring up the bill and I tear it in two or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, alcohol is seen as this reward for, like, authority, this reward for dominance. Like, if you're in the right spot, all the booze just comes to you for free. And then when we have the flashbacks of the Paris scene, they're drinking the champagne because the Nazis are on the way, and they said, you know, they'd rather just pour it in the garden than have the Nazis drink it. And I don't know, I think alcohol is just this very powerful thing. Like, it's freedom. It's like, it's what comes with power, but and with what comes with not just authority, but what comes with freedom. Like, to be a free citizen of your country means you can just drink all the time and no one's going to come and take your champagne or whatever. And, you know, we also get dramatic shots of, you know, people dying and their drink falling over and things like that, and this precious liquid being spilled, someone dies, and it's present, people drinking all the time. It seems to be very important to people, and not just as a way to get drunk, but as this like citizenship and this expression. And I think it's probably most clearly vivified at the end when Renault throws out that bottle of Vichy wine, I think it is.
Yeah.
And he's just fully rejected, like, that government and that, what I think a lot of the French people understood as a betrayal when the Vichy and the Nazis struck what people see as a very one-sided deal for the Nazis just because they had more power. Mm-hmm. And this was just kind of a slow push for more power. He throws that bottle out, and that's it's kind of Renault doing what we've seen Rick do. Like, those two are really battling throughout most of this movie about who can give less of a fuck about anything. Like, that's what this movie is for a long time. Like, Renault is pointing out, you know, all these precedents that, and how he seems to be passionate about some things that he just never assumed he cared about. And he's, Renault is saying, like, oh, you, I knew you're more sentimental than you give off or whatever. We have kind of that noble character, that noble, like reluctantly noble hero with Rick. That also is Renault's journey too. And I mean, he is not nearly as central to the movie as Rick and doesn't have the love interest angle. I guess he does.
I mean, depending how you read the movie. Yeah.
He does in a very gross way. Not in the gay way, but I mean, I think it's implied that he's exchanging sexual favors from a lot of these refugees in order for them to move on. Yeah, I think it's interesting that Renault kind of has a similar trajectory, obviously with less of the elements, just because he's not essential to the story. But it's that, you know, he takes right up until the very end to take a stand on something. Like, I think we see Rick, you know, kind of two thirds of the way through this movie, really start standing up for what he believes in. You know, there's references to him really caring more than he lets off throughout the first two thirds, but I think at the two thirds mark, he really kind of embraces that and speaks honestly about, you know, his love for Ilsa and his passion for Laszlo and the work that Laszlo does and how much he admires that work and the risk that he puts himself at to continue doing it. And it's, you know, Rick isn't just the hero because he, you know, started acting the way that he always felt he should. He's the hero because he's inspiring everyone around him as well. And it takes someone to be as bold as Rick to get the people like Renault, who are completely on the fence, to go the right way. And Rick is not, was never really on the fence as much as he claimed to be. And I think Renault is a better person than he lets off, but he's just more terrified than Rick until he sees Rick do something and kind of gets inspired by that. And Rick really does force him into a corner to pick a side. But I just get the sense that Rick's reluctance to engage in anything is more out of a negative experience and, you know, having been jaded to the notion of love, whereas Renault's, I think, is just absolute fear. Like, he just wants to survive. And, you know, oh, the Nazis are here. Okay, guess that's cool now. Like, he's just, I just get the feeling that he is so afraid, and that Rick's journey is not only just one of self-discovery, but one of, you know, kind of inspiration for everyone around him.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think the big World War II allegory out of all this, obviously this is, World War II is very central to this movie. And it is remarkable this movie came out in 1942, by the way. But I think we're meant to Rick as America, or I don't know, FDR, but America as well. And just someone who didn't want to get involved. And that's what we saw with, you know, the American policy of isolationism in the 30s and early 40s. Literally in this movie, they say isolationism is no longer a viable policy. And they are speaking about, you know, Rick kind of having to choose sides on something eventually. Isolationism was very much the policy of America leading up to World War II. And I just like that line a lot, because it hits on the two main things about this movie. I think the clear allegory to World War II, but then also Rick's romance, which I think is, as we said, just so central to this movie. And him to stand in for America in that way, I think was really, really interesting. And I like that line was so on the nose, even though sometimes I say I hate when things are that on the nose. I really enjoyed that. And just this idea of, I mean, this isn't much after Pearl Harbor that this movie comes out, which is why I say it's so remarkable that it was that quick. I mean, Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941, and this is 1942, as we said. But it was just this idea of, you know, No, this is a very revised version of American history I'm about to drop on you. But just this idea that kind of America was just staying out of it. You know, like they kind of had their idea of what was the right thing to do, but they just stayed out of it until they were forced. And, you know, Pearl Harbor came around and it was like, okay, now you're in this fight. You have to pick a side. And that's what kind of Bogey was doing for so much of this movie, or what Rick was doing for so much of this movie, was just like, I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to get involved. And you see kind of a glimpse of what he truly believes and what he thinks is right and wrong, and maybe he'll act on, you know, a little tidbit of that once in a while, but then he just keeps putting it off until the Pearl Harbor that is Ilsa's return kind of forces him to do something and forces him to fight, and, you know, I think forces him to join World War II to run with that allegory. And as I said about him, about Rick not only just doing something for himself and kind of finally owning up to who he is, but I think America liked the idea that them joining this war would not only be great for them, but inspire the world and, you know, bring everyone together as allies to defeat the Nazis. And again, that's not exactly how they entered World War II. Understand that, but I think as a piece of, you know, Hollywood media, I think it gets a ton of things across for, you know, mobilizing the public into a war that not everyone is completely sold on from the get-go.
Yeah, I see it and I agree with it.
Okay. What's interesting to me though, like, is to run with that idea of you know, like, let's have the viewer stand in. Like, if we're going to look at this purely as a piece of propaganda, which I don't think this was created purely as a piece of propaganda, but yeah. I think for the reasons I just described can function that way. Mm-hmm. The interesting part is that Rick's personal and political goals are opposing, which I think is something very weird for Hollywood at that time, or Hollywood now. I think that, you know, the idea of propaganda is to align your personal goals with your political goals. And, you know, if you follow everything personally and politically, those should, like, do those well, then you should be happy, and those things are going to coalesce, because being a good person in one facet of life is being a good citizen and being, you know, all these other good things. And that's why I think it's interesting that it's such a classic Hollywood movie, and it's such a good, like, exemplar of Hollywood filmmaking at the time, but it's not really a Hollywood ending. Like, yeah. He does. Weird that this movie sets up the idea of being a good American isn't going to make you personally happy. Like, I think that's oddly subversive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just because the way that people focus on Casablanca, for the most part, is just Rick and Ilsa. And it's just sort of like the way I think most people would remember the movie ending is that, oh, Rick sacrificed his happiness for Ilsa's, because he kind of let go of what they had and was able to move on and make a new friend and walk down the runway together. I understand what you're saying. I think that's just not the note that I would imagine most people left the cinema thinking about, you know, since this movie does focus more pointedly on Rick and Ilsa more than anything. I think that's sort of what people are thinking about as the movie concludes, is the conclusion of the most pointed parts of the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I don't think that, I mean, if we're going to say that's the central point of this movie, they don't end up together. I get what you're saying. Like, it's his sacrifice is the big romantic gesture. Yes. Love isn't always about spending the most time with the person you love, but it's about making them happy. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily about being with them. It's just making sure that they're happy wherever they are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess that gets summed up with the line about, you know, the problems of three people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world, or whatever that is exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's just odd to me. I mean, if we think of this as centrally a love story, just the idea of the two people who, it just seems inevitable they're going to get together somehow. Don't get together. Mm-hmm. And he, I don't know. I think, I mean, just to go back to the World War, again, I'm really not trying to get all Illuminati conspiracy on this one, but just the idea that, like, with these people, I mean, World War II had a draft. We, you know, millions of people were sent over against their will, and it was a much different country as a result. I think that what we could, one way to read this is that, like, you have to sacrifice, and your personal things sometimes go by the wayside in exchange for a better world. Yeah. And you're going to lose a husband or a son or a wife or a daughter for this war effort, but you know it was the right thing to do. Like, let's all be Ricks about this and just put our personal things aside and make sure that we're standing by our morality as a nation.
Yeah, no, I get that, and I definitely think that's there. I think my only argument is that, like a lot of this movie, how it's so much of it is put together piece by piece by a lot of different people. I don't think it was necessarily a point of the movie that it was trying to make. Not that that makes it invalid, but I just think that the majority of the people certainly did not come out of the movie thinking that. And I think it's entirely possible that the you know, the Warners didn't notice this as they were releasing the movie into the cinematic wild, you know.
Yeah, I didn't. They were Warner Brothers was the first openly anti-Nazi studio, which is a weird statement to have to make, but yeah, at a time like that is. That really was a stand at one point in the 30s, you know. Mm-hmm. Harry M. Warner was making public speeches against the Nazis action. Well, not Nazis at the time, but that action in Germany in 1936, which is, you know, 5 years before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So it was something that, I mean, they were aware of somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a message I think that even with kind of filmmaking by committee was probably considered at one point, but
yeah,
I don't know. It seems like the kind of the best studio as far as let's make a stand on this. Let's kind of call a spade to make another Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He like, it's funny how Rick kind of has the dilemma. He could easily get Laszlo out of this picture very easily. Mm-hmm. Like, it's Laszlo's on very thin ice this entire movie. Rick seems to have some sway. It's just funny that Laszlo is the most one-dimensional character in this whole movie. Like, he's just pure heroism.
Yeah, for sure.
There's just nothing else to him. And, you know, Rick is kind of put in a position, if he's like, if I literally sold out the idea of being a hero and sacrificing yourself for others and putting yourself at risk for your fellow countrymen, I could get this girl. But yeah. No, Rick wouldn't do that.
No, he wouldn't. That involves too much emotion, too much, even if it's of the negative kind. I did enjoy I know we talked about how little I think is in this movie visually. The shot of Rick walking through empty Ricks is gorgeous. It's right towards the end. And I found that really interesting, and it kind of plays into the point you're making in an abstract way, is that, you know, how he had created this protective shell for himself, but even that eventually gets closed down and turns into nothing, you know, like it can't protect him forever. And he, that shot is of him, I think he's going to answer the door and he's just walking across, and it's all in one take. He walks across the floor and opens the door. But it's just shot so wide, and the space looks so empty, and he's the only person in it. And it's like this visual representation of loneliness, and it's very beautiful and wonderful. And I think that's sort of around the time when he kind of feels like, okay, I need to kind of change something. I need to do something. And I think it's very much still up in the air in Rick's head, what he's going to do up until, you know, the last scene of the movie, more or less, whether he's going to basically betray Laszlo or send them both away, or send Laszlo away. But I think the thing that is interesting is that in this place of emptiness that Rick then sells, he gets rid of, he basically realizes he needs to find a new purpose in life. Like, he's allowed this one thing to sort of haunt him, Ilsa specifically. He's a woman has stuck with him, broke his heart, and he just wasn't willing to move past it. He wasn't willing to fight for anything, good or bad. And I think that move, the end of the movie is definitely about him, like you said, kind of picking up a fight of some kind. And just the idea that of finding purpose for himself is very important to the ending of this movie. And it gives him something to do, even though the thing he spent, or the woman that he spent the entirety of the movie thinking about until pretty much the last 2 minutes of the movie is gone, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I enjoyed that, and I think that works side by side with the points you're trying to make, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you know who Ilsa prefers?
Oh, no. I don't know. I suppose, I think, I don't know. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about Ilsa. Also, I don't think the movie spends a lot of time thinking about Ilsa. But maybe this is just me being misogynist. I don't know.
No, she's got the good face. That's all you need.
Yeah, that Billy Bean good face. Yeah. She's got the good face and the insane backlighting.
Yeah, there's a little much of that, eh?
Oh, my God. Everybody in this movie is lit away, and then Ingrid Bergman is lit an entirely different way. I told you about that producer I worked with that worked on American Idol. He talked about how Mariah Carey has her own director of photography.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I feel about Ingrid Bergman in this movie, that she just has, there's an entirely new setup that has to come in when Ingrid Bergman is on stage, on the soundstage.
Every time.
Yeah.
did you read about kind of how international the cast of this was?
Very quickly I did. Yeah, it seemed like there were a lot of refugees basically in the movie.
there's three American born actors in the entire cast, and mm-hmm. I mean, I know that it seems like it's a small movie with only really three people, but it's a decent number of talking parts when you think about it.
Well, that's one of the things I find the most fascinating about this movie is this movie feels gigantic. There are so many distinct characters that I think are set up so quickly and somehow in a way that doesn't feel rushed. I don't know. It's really odd. That's one of the most impressive things I find about this movie is how many different characters there are. And how many of them I actually remember, even when I'm just thinking about the movie. Even, you know, somebody like the pickpocket that's in two scenes for a minute. You know, he's just, there's enough fleshed out about him that I remember him, you know?
Yeah, and from a screenwriting standpoint, I watched this movie and then I watched it again, and I was amazed by how quickly they get into the meat of this movie. Like, that pickpocket does some good exposition, which isn't, I mean that honestly, like, it's really not that clunky because it's very entertaining how he does it.
Yeah.
But other than Ilsa's arrival, like, this movie's pretty fleshed out very quickly. Like, it's just a very tight script. And speaking of small parts, Peter Lorre is just the best.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about him. He's just too good. That pickpocket has one of the longest careers in film ever.
Oh, really? Always playing a pickpocket or a variety of
No, films? But his first credit is in 1907 and his last is in 1987.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Pretty awesome. I just thought that that bared mentioning. As we were just saying, tons of refugees, lots of people who just had escaped or been exiled from Europe worked on this movie in different capacities. And I guess some people got pretty emotional during that kind of dueling anthem scene we were talking about, because, I mean, they were singing songs from their continent, from maybe their country. And they just said a lot of the actors and extras during the making of that scene got really emotional because it's an emotional scene, but to think of this in 1942 when, some of the worst atrocities of the war are going on, or when so many people are having to flee Europe. It's very remarkable. Like, I was still blown away by how quick, how modern this movie felt, considering the weight of so much of what they were dealing with.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
that was such a pensive yeah. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just really into my ideas right now. No, but I'm just reading about some of these, like Conrad Veidt, who played Colonel Strasser, I think. He had a Jewish wife, ended up playing a bunch of Nazis in American movies. I don't know. That's just so incredible to me. And I just have such distance from that. Like, and this whole movie just, you know, as a reflection of where Rick is, kind of in this no man's land and just stuck in between things. Like, that's very much where the world is at this point. Like, this world war isn't quite exploded to the size it was going to. And I mean, I saw Sound of Music recently too. It's just really weird to have these people who are like, I'm not sure about these Nazi guys. I get a bad vibe from them. But, yeah. No, it's a movie that I think partially succeeds by having like a compelling story on his own, like Rick's story as a narrative in isolation, I think works. But if you kind of extrapolate that into what's happening in America and what's happening in North Africa and what's happening in the world at that point, movie kind of fell into, you know, not to discredit any of the people who worked on it, but like, as we said, like there wasn't huge expectations. This kind of happened. And, as did America's involvement in World War II. Like, there's just so many things line up for this movie. I think it's a perfect role for Bogart. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, it's a fine piece of storytelling on its own, and then you can connect it to these bigger things. And I think that's what makes it, you know, one of the movies from the 40s that sticks around and still, it's a very different movie than we see now. But I think, like, watching it, there's still something very immediate and impactful about it, even with all these kind of disparaged parts and different ways to come about putting a movie together. I think it succeeds.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good note to end on.
Okay.
The successes of Casablanca. So thank you for listening to MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week for our next episode.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.